afternoon I'd like to reflect on the theme of equanimity. And I'd like to begin by reading to you a piece written by a woman as she, about the profound shift she experienced as she accompanied her 3-year-old daughter on her journey through terminal cancer. And she wrote, she said, "It was right then that it happened. It was such a strange and glorious thing that if I hadn't experienced it myself, I wouldn't have believed it possible. I forgot that Hannah was sick. I wasn't even aware of having forgotten. If I had been sucked out of the story of cancer treatment, worry, and death. Hannah was playing in the dirt and I was visiting with a friend. It was a moment of nothing special, of nothing going on. In a flash, whatever had sucked me up spit me out again. Even so, something felt different. Although I remembered now that Hannah was sick, some part of the stillness had remained. Later, I sat in the front porch, peeling away the layers of the night sky. The night sky was like my life. Each layer a level of experience. No element or moment of it was more or less, better or worse than any other. Each was an offering to the whole in its suspended, inky stillness. Listening to the night, I felt poised on the edge of greatness, certain that the silence I was feeling was sacred." I think there can be moments in our life amidst all the swirling events, all the joys and sorrows, that we can find ourselves touched by intimations of a great inner stillness, a stillness that embraces the whole of life. And sometimes those glimpses can be very startling. They can take us by surprise. We've seen how we can move in moments from intense preoccupation and worry and obsession and planning in a moment to a place of an inner poise and stillness. In those shifts, we have a glimpse of what equanimity is and how the nature of equanimity is this unshakable balance and stillness. Now, equanimity is sometimes described as a spacious stillness of mind, as a radiant calm. Sometimes it's described as an inner poise. Some traditions call it a shamanic equilibrium. And yet this unshakable balance that we can find is not something that's removed and distant from life. It's not something dependent on our life being muted or subdued. But it is rather within our life and more within our willingness and capacity to meet all the moments of our life with equal respect and compassion and sensitivity that we find that equanimity. I think something, actually quite a lot of it is asked of us to meet our life with that equal respect. Think of how much we have to let go of our ideas of being for and against. Think of being of right and wrong, of good and bad. Think of how much we have to surrender all of the cycles and the avenues of avoidance and pursuit, of seeking and denial, to find that equality of respect. A Tibetan teacher once described equanimity as being equally near all things. And certainly equanimity is part of the tapestry, part of the fabric of the path of the Bodhisattva of compassion. It's like, if we're going to really know what it means to be still and open in the midst of suffering in our world, We have to learn how to meet life without fear and without resistance. We have to somehow learn how to put down some of our ideas of what should be and what should not be. And sometimes we sense we can do that. And what happens when we can do this is that we find ourselves able to listen. We find ourselves able to listen to the story of another and to the story of life. And to find that quality of receptivity and listening, which is so much part of compassion. It's almost as if we have to learn how to calm our own inner story about life. Because our inner story is sometimes what holds so much of the history and the fear and the prejudice. And when that can calm and become more still, it is almost as if we are able to hear the story of life telling itself to us. Now, equanimity is the forerunner of wise speech and the wise actions that truly make a difference in life. It's very rare that speech and that actions that are born of agitation and fear of craving can really be received or listened to by another. But when our speech and our actions can come from a place of inner stillness and inner balance, they are the ones that can actually really touch the heart of another. Hui Neng once said, "To what should we compare equanimity and wisdom? They are like the light of a lamp. Having the lamp, you can have the light. But with no lamp, there must be darkness. Because the lamp is the basis of the light, and the light is the use of the lamp. Though there are two names, the basis is the same. The teaching of equanimity and wisdom is just like this." In my understanding, equanimity is not a place. It's not a state, not something that we attain and then retire. But equanimity is an ongoing journey. I mean, just as life doesn't stand still for us, frozen in time, where nothing ever changes anymore, our equanimity needs to be equally fluid. A way of meeting our shifting life. A way of meeting the changes in our bodies and minds and all of the events that come to us. Now, I know sometimes we can feel, especially when our minds seem so chaotic, we can feel like this inner stillness is unreachable, impossible for us. We may even feel that it's just too hard to be balanced and steady amidst all the changes and the extremes in our life. But actually, I think it only takes a brief moment of reflection for us to see and to know how much harder it is on us to be perpetually lost in the extremes of love and hate, and happiness and despair, of being for and against. This is what truly wearies and exhausts us. Now, equanimity is not a word that we use very much in our culture. We seldom, you know, get up in our day and say, "Well, I feel deeply equanimous. You know, I've had a really equanimous day." I mean, there's other words in our vocabulary, I think, that we use with much greater frequency. You know, we say, "I love this," or "I really hate this," or "I look forward to tomorrow," "I dread the next sitting," or "I'm really against this," or "I really need this," "I really want this." You know, if you meet a friend that you haven't seen for a while, and they ask you how you've been, how often that is just a kind of open door to pour out the story of all of the events that have happened to us and within us. You know, we tell them, "I've had such an awful time," or "Life has been so exciting," or "I've been so sad," or, you know, "I've been so fearful," "I've been in love." we don't very often say, nothing happened. My mind has been unmoving. Composure and poise has been my home. We almost feel, you know, it's almost as if we said something like that, it's almost that that's associated with it, somehow presenting ourselves as being this very dull person. You know, this very uninteresting, unexciting person who's just going to be ignored. When the Buddha got up from the Bodhi tree, he said, I gained absolutely nothing from complete, unexcelled enlightenment. It's so interesting that we have made this event under the Bodhi tree into this event. This image we have. He said, nothing happened. Now, one way of framing our life is to see it as being this unceasing and almost unstoppable flow of events, one following on the heels of another. Sometimes it feels too fast for us to meet. Some of you probably remember that song from very long ago. It says, stop the world, I want to get off. And I think we can feel this. It is almost like our life, if we use the sort of metaphor of life being like this great river that starts with this tiny spring that comes to the surface of the ground, that grows and grows in power. And in the course of that river, there are stretches of white water and rapids. There are places of calm that turn then into whirlpools that can once more even out, only then to turn into a waterfall. And none of us would imagine that we could choose to stop the river. Just as we can't stop the arising and the passing of the events in our life, and we can't even choose that we would only have the stretches of calm, we're not even sure we would want to choose that. Nor could we choose to stay forever in the wild and white water. Now, in the events of our life, we're all going to receive our own measure of praise and blame, of approval and disapproval. We're all going to meet gain and loss, pleasure and pain, what are called the eight worldly dharmas. These eight worldly dharmas are almost a way of describing the events in our life in which we are most prone to find ourselves in the extremes of happiness and sorrow, of despair and hope, of craving and aversion. What I would call the comfort and the discomfort zones of our life. If we think of all of the events within one single life, what the Buddha called the 10,000 joys and sorrows, it seems, or it can seem, as if so many of these events are almost created and designed and poised to knock us off balance. We see how easily we are knocked off balance. By pleasure, by pain, by gain, by loss, by approval, by disapproval. We can't imagine ever reaching a point in our life where we would have enough armor and enough defense to keep the world of events at a distance. We can't imagine ever reaching a point in our life where we could, you know, quite comfortably say, oh, now I've got everything under control. You know, I'm never going to be startled by change again. And nothing is ever, ever going to ambush me again. We could imagine reaching a point in our life where we say, oh, stability of events has been achieved. I think the only things that we can count on in this life is that nothing is going to truly belong to us. that nothing will stay and that nothing will remain the same. You know, we encounter this all the time, this possibility of extremes in the events in our life. I know teaching, you know, sometimes we'll give a talk, you know, and then you go to the notice board afterward, you know, and you've got the fors and againsts, you know. It was four notes saying, God, that was the most inspiring talk I've ever heard in my life. And before then I was saying, you know, you really missed the point. You know, what do you do with that? What do we do with these events in our life? We see it, we gain approval, and how quickly we're hooked, you know. We're basking in it, you know, telling ourselves how well we're doing. And then a moment later, something else can happen and we feel ashamed as we're showered with disapproval. We see that our great meditation, you know, the one we always longed for and finally got, disappears in a moment. Our great love, our state of health, our youth. All can be lost. All can change into something less welcome. Pleasure can turn to pain. It was a woman who lived, a mother who lived in the town next to where I lived. And she told about how she received in the mail one day, just after Christmas, a postcard from her son who died in the tsunami. And the postcard said, I'm in heaven. This is the best time of my life. And these changes between pleasure and pain, I think, are not always so life-shattering. In fact, sometimes we don't notice it because they're not life-shattering. We can find ourselves, you know, enjoying the sound of the bird outside the window, and then the power washer turns up, you know. Our delightful fantasy and plan, we have this illusion we can only choose the delightful ones. You know, our delightful fantasy and plan turns into some sort of nightmarish obsession. Pain can also turn into delight. You know, we can be so lost in some intense story and preoccupation. And then we can walk outside and look at a flower blooming and just feel it all fall away. You know, the pain we experience can turn actually in a moment into a sense of well-being. I think what we become sensitive to is how our balance, our sense of balance in this life, can seem so fragile and so precarious. And yet the events go on. And in the midst of all these events, we still breathe. We still get up in the morning. We go to bed at night. We remain present and alive. And I think sometimes we do ask ourselves how our hearts can continue to absorb this stream of events and extremes in this life without being shattered. We ask ourselves how we could find the equanimity that would enable us to meet all of these events with equal respect, without being governed by them. And this is a real and valid question. What does it mean to live in a way in which we're not governed by the changing events? You know, how deeply can we understand that our efforts to control the uncontrollable are in vain and futile, and in fact they only make us suffer? Equanimity, I think, really does ask for the wisdom of a Buddha. It is not only the outer events in our life that really ask us to find this radical calm, but also the inner events. I had the pleasure and the privilege of being in the States last November during your election, and I got together with a few colleagues and friends, and we were spending the evening in front of the TV, probably as many of you were, watching this. And it was so interesting to watch this roller coaster. You know, you see this starting to watch this with a little bit of a sense of hope that gradually turned into despair, only to re-arise moments later and then to turn into sadness and frustration. And then, of course, we're all waiting for Ohio, you know. And again, there was this arising sense of optimism, so dashed again. And it was so evident and so clear in that moment that there were countless people around the world, around the country, watching exactly the same event, experiencing the same ups and downs of emotions, yet totally at opposite times. You know, that my despair was somebody else's great happiness. You know, that my frustration was somebody else's tremendous sense of satisfaction. That my hope was somebody else's sorrow. All depending upon our frame of reference. Depending upon our likes and dislikes, our for and against. Now, we would ask ourselves, does equanimity mean that we never feel these emotions? That we're never sad or we're never happy or that we never experience fear or sorrow or joy? I think not. This is not what equanimity means. It's something I'd like to read to you. Probably many of you have heard it before, but it says, if you can sit quietly after difficult news, if in financial downturns you remain perfectly calm, if you can see your neighbors travel to fantastic places without a twinge of jealousy, if you can happily eat whatever is put on your plate, if you can love those around you unconditionally, if you can fall asleep after a day of running around without a drink or a pill, if you can always find contentment just where you are probably a dog. Equanimity is not the absence of feeling. Equanimity is the presence of balance in the world of feeling. As I mentioned earlier, when Hui Ning talked about the wisdom of equanimity, of how equanimity and wisdom are really two sides of the same coin, then it's really important to look at what is the wisdom element of equanimity. I think the first cornerstone of that wisdom is the cultivation of first our willingness and then our capacity to embrace the reality of impermanence, of change. And I might say here that I think that our capacity follows in the footsteps of our willingness. Can we truly understand that written upon every single thing that comes into being, that is born, is actually the story of its passing and its death? Our moments of fame and disgrace, our love, our hate, our pleasure, our pain, our gain, our loss, none of them are graspable. All of them are held equally in the fabric of change and impermanence. We know this. And yet, at the same time, this is an area where we're subject to the greatest bouts of amnesia. Forever. Forever. This is a thought we often have. Either we want something to be forever, or we fear that it will be forever. Without deeply embracing the reality of impermanence, we are prone to fall out of balance. We're prone to be lost in aversion and resistance, and we become then equally lost in forgetfulness. Think about how much heroic effort we expend in our life to try and keep and maintain and preserve that which is already passing. When we fall into the extremes of being for and against, what we sacrifice is our capacity to be equally near all things, to meet all things with equal respect. I remember some years ago at IMS, some of you may have been there, but years ago, you know, there used to be this vast assortment of, you know, chipped and cute and weird plates and bowls and cups. And one day, housekeeping decided that they were going to change all of this into something that was much simpler and more standard. So they bought all these sets of just plain white dishes. Well, you would have thought, you know, this was not a big thing, you know. And yet for months afterwards, they found themselves deluged with these notes. What have you done with my favorite cup? How can I start my retreat so upset? You know, where is my favorite plate going? What kind of standardization are you trying to impose upon us? Now, we might remember this was all happening in a center that gives an ongoing emphasis in teaching on impermanence. I think we don't always realize how much we rely upon the great and the small things in our life staying the same for us to feel balanced and calm until they change. And then I think we get a sense of how subtly this thread of grasping runs through our life. Now, we're not short of opportunities to contemplate impermanence, to contemplate beginnings and endings, birth and death. If we just open our heart to the truth of a single hour, a single day, and ask what it is teaching us, what have we been asked to learn today? And one lesson that has been stamped all through that hour, all through that day, is that this too will pass. And understanding this deeply is one of the great cornerstones of equanimity. Another of the wisdom cornerstones of equanimity is actually, I think, our willingness to explore and to understand the nature of our intoxication. You know, if someone offered you a lifelong free pass to the highest roller coaster in the world, initially, depending on your temperament, you might feel that this was quite a prize. And the first few rides, you would probably even really enjoy the thrill and the exhilaration, not only of the intensity of the ride, but also the intensity of our own emotions. And then imagine if you had to do it day after day, hour after hour. I could well imagine that for most of us, the thrill would start to wear pretty thin. And yet, strangely, we don't seem to lose our intoxication in riding the roller coaster of events in our life, outwardly and inwardly, in the same way. And I think it's good to see that where there is intoxication, equanimity disappears. Now, what is it? What is it that draws us? What is it that enchants us? What is it that leads us to become so intoxicated with the events in our life? Why is it that we find ourselves prowling the world, you know, looking for the new experience? What is it that these extremes of love and hate and gain and loss, of pleasure and pain, what is it that they feed in us? Personally, I think that it takes only just a little awareness to see that our sense of self, our sense of who we are, is also an event. It's an event that arises and passes in countless different forms in relationship to other events. Now, in a single hour, in a single day, how many self events do you experience? I'm happy, I'm sad, I'm getting somewhere, I'm stuck, I'm young, I'm old, I'm anxious, I'm excited. And the events of self are arising and passing. They're always co-joined with other events that are arising and passing. The sense of self is arising and passing that event alongside the inner events of our emotions, our thoughts, our opinions, our feelings, our reactions. And they're arising and passing in relationship to the world of outer events. Now, the event of self and the other events of our inner and outer world are mutually codependent. Sometimes we see that the sense of ourself, the event of ourself, is flavored by an outer event. You know, there's a sudden noise in the hall. And you can find the event of the anxious or the angry self leaping to the forefront. Now, why is that person so unmindful? At times, outer events are flavored by an inner event. You know, perhaps we find ourselves sitting with a memory or an emotion of sadness or anger. And we see that everything then in the world almost is ripe in its potential to irritate us. Now, the question is, who are we outside of the event? Who would we be without the definition of an event? Now this, in my understanding, is the source of our intoxication. That I need an event to be someone. And the thought of being no one can be so unfamiliar and so initially unsettling that we resist it fiercely. And there are no end of the events that life offers to us in the potential to be someone. Now, the short answer to who we would be without being defined by an event is that we would be equanimous. There's a Zen verse says, 10,000 flowers in spring, the moon in autumn, a cool breeze in summer, snow in winter. If your mind is not clouded by unnecessary things, this is the best season of your life. My sense is that the unnecessary things are our positions of being for and against, of our likes and dislikes, our fears and anticipations. The unnecessary things are the changing definitions of self. Learning to release the unnecessary things, then our equanimity becomes richer, it deepens. Now the third dimension of wisdom that we bring mindfulness to so equanimity can deepen is the dimension of what is called in this tradition Vedana, or feeling, the second foundation of mindfulness. To know the pleasant as the pleasant, to know the unpleasant as unpleasant, to know the neutral as neutral. I think when we are unmindful of Vedana, when we are unmindful of the feeling tones in all things, then we take the first steps towards intoxication, towards being knocked off balance. To cultivate equanimity, we are asked to practice in the places where we are not equanimous, in the spectrum of feelings that arise. Now, in our life, there is that which is pleasant, has a pleasant Vedana, pleasant sounds, pleasant sights, pleasant thoughts, pleasant taste, pleasant touch, pleasant smells. There are many of these in our life, probably not as many as we would like, but many. Now, equanimity doesn't demand that we resist the pleasant, because the pleasant is the birthplace, the root of joy, of rapture, of loving kindness, of appreciation. But the pleasant is also the place where craving builds its house, and where we become lost in events. If you take a walk outside, it's really pleasant. And we delight in it. And how often do we just leave it there? You know, how often do we make it into an event with our story? Oh, it's so amazing. You know, I'd like to write a book about this. You know, next time I come here, I'm going to bring a guidebook to trees and flowers. You know, maybe bring a picnic. You know, I'll see if I've got a room to rent out here. You know, and the pleasant has turned into a project, into an event. Do we appreciate it more through that? I don't think so. I think it is much more our endeavor to appropriate it into a self-event. Now, there is probably much more unpleasant Vedana in life than we would like. Unpleasant sounds, thoughts, feelings, taste, touch, experience. But our dislike and our resistance will not shelter us from them. It might rain tomorrow. You know how often we can go into that. This is so terrible. You know, I'm going to move to Florida. You know, my next retreat's going to be in the summer. Much of life is actually quite neutral. It's neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And here, our tendency is not to get lost in craving, not to get lost in aversion. But here, our tendency much more is to space out, to disassociate. It is interesting that the neutral is the most difficult place for the sense of self to find a foothold. It's the most difficult place for the sense of self to become an event. So what happens? Is it apparently nothing is apparently happening? Therefore, I am not happening. So we tell ourselves a story about this. We tell ourselves, this is boring. I'm boring. The breath is boring. Try not breathing. Becomes much less boring. Now, of course, life is happening. Life is happening. There are no events of me to take hold of, but life is happening. Inviting our sensitivity, inviting us to be present with equal respect. Instead of taking up that invitation more and more, we find ourselves wanting to disconnect, to find more room for craving and aversion to play out. Now, equanimity is really a practice of learning to let go of craving, of learning to let go of aversion, and of learning to let go of disassociation. This is where we find equanimity. It's where we find the radiant calm that illuminates and embraces all things, with a sense that nothing is lacking. I think what is released in that equanimity is our capacity to meet our life inwardly and outwardly with respect. The finding this quality of balance is a practice. And to find balance, we actually need to be deeply interested in the places where we get knocked off balance. The path of equanimity is not separate from the world of suffering and chaos, but really finds its roots within it, within the midst of events, in the midst of change, in the midst of suffering. This is where we learn that we can embrace this world without being embittered or fearful or overwhelmed. On deeper levels, this equanimity in our practice is a kind of eventless mindfulness. Life is still happening. We breathe, we sit, we walk, but in a sense, nothing happens. Because nothing is isolated, nothing is taken out of this stream of life and made into an event. I think in that eventless mindfulness, we really do find this very deep inner stillness that is unshakable. I think Rumi talks about it in this poem when he says, this being human is a guest house, every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. But even if there are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture, still treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. If we have just a couple of moments quietly together.